coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this special pre-recorded edition of The Curious Realm. I'm out on the road right now tending to client needs as we speak in Orlando. But as always, and as always promised, we do not do replay here. We do not do repeat content, though we may recycle things for social media use. Our live stream is always live. It is always new content. Every episode is always new stuff. In this episode tonight, folks, in the second part after commercial break, we will be talking with our good friend Gretchen Cornwall, Knights Templar researcher. We will talk with her about pre-Columbian visits of Vikings to North America and how word of those spread to the Knights Templar in France, which, of course, brought them over here for riches and glory and all kinds of fun stuff, and maybe hiding treasures, and maybe even visiting places like America's Stonehenge. Our guest in the first segment is the amazing Dennis Stone. His family has owned this beautiful plot of land and amazing megalithic site that is right here in the backyard of America. Welcome back to the show, Dennis. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing pretty good, Chris. Thank you so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. You and America's Stonehenge are two of my favorite topics that we have on this show. It is absolutely confounding what this site is, what it was possibly used for, and the archaeoastronomic alignments. They are massive. They're huge. There is such a large complex that you are constantly uncovering and finding new things with. So you just got the book out. Whoop. The book just came out. Tell us a little bit about what is in the book and what the location's all about, Dennis.
Right. Yeah. Well, we decided to start this book about 2019. We had just finished a souvenir book on the site, which replaced the 1996 book. The last book that was written about the site was actually in 2003, so over about 21 years ago. My dad was part of that book, and the author was David Galdsworth. And that book replaced the 1977 book, which replaced the 1946 book all about the site. So we're going back quite a few decades of research, about 87 years now of research, and we keep finding, as you mentioned, new things on the property. Kind of a surprise to us that we're still finding things after all these years, because these woods have been walked around by all the different researchers starting in the 1930s. And yet some of these things are hiding in plain sight almost, you know. And so my book basically takes you up to this year, all the recent discoveries, the different technology that's been used on the site over the years for research, and the latest on the LIDAR imaging, penetration imaging, and even a DNA test that we did on some bones found back in 1937.
Oh, wow.
Those are some of the things my book covers, but it covers about almost 90 years of the research, and then it goes back in time covering the history of the site, going back into the, oh, this early 1700s, the Patty family. Then it goes back, of course, into the prehistory of what the site, what types of artifacts have been found there. As you mentioned, the astronomy of the site, the different stone tools, utensils, and weapons that have been found over the years on the site. About 1% of the hills excavated in about, 9 years. So there's a lot more that's still probably hidden in the ground, if you will. And that picture right there is so cool. That's some of the 37 alignments for the sun, the moon, and stars. And that's about 15 acres of the main, what we call the main site, with its surrounding walls. Outside that area is 90 more acres of walls and different features that we found in the last few years, including serpentine walls, walls that are shaped like a snake. We've discussed that on previous shows. Today we have, yeah, I believe we have 15 serpent walls. One was just found a month ago. And a gentleman from Kansas City who films for Prime and also for Showtime has been to our site twice. He came in this family last year, was pretty much taken by the site. And then he flew back up for a special event back about 5 weeks ago. Scott Walters was up for the day, and Haley Ramsey was up. And we had a whole event that day, and they came, you know, to do this event. A day before the event, however, that film producer was walking with one of my staff, a general manager, James Lacefield. And they were out looking at some Winter Solstice Sunset. Winter Solstice Sunset was first opened in 1965, so we've been looking at the walls and the monolith very closely. But that morning, while they're out there looking at some of the outside walls, they discovered another window out there. And these windows now number about 28 on the property. And so he happened to be there to witness that discovery. And about an hour later, I joined him. And on the northwest part of the property, they were on the southwest side. The northwest side, way out in the woods, we found what appears to be another serpent with a gigantic boulder head with a window in its body, another one of these windows. And so that morning, they found, we found two more windows in the serpentine wall. So MIPOP covers all of that, and it has a lot of the different researchers that have participated in the research over the years. It has an appendix in the back that covers the carbon datings and the astronomical data, and also other types of research that have been done on the site. So it kind of brings the reader up to date of the site, because we don't have all the answers still. It's, you know, the book actually will be subject to probably an update in the next coming years, you know, with some new materials, you know.
Yeah.
The most recent book, and we spent about 5 years working on it. It did get slowed down because of COVID. My daughter-in-law, Kathleen, was actually, she was helping us do the editing on it. And then COVID hit. She took some time off from work, and also then she had our granddaughter. So that was even more time taken off. But in the meantime, we did more research, such as the DNA, the OSL dating, the ground penetration radar, more research for that, and the LIDAR for the first time, handheld LIDAR. And that is all in the book now. If you put the book out 5 years ago, all of that wouldn't have been in the book. You'd have to do an update of the book.
Yeah.
So that's two. So kind of excited that the book's out after all the years. And it's the fifth book on our site since, you know, the 1930s, actually. Yeah. 1946, I mentioned that book by Mr. Goodman. So that's what the book is, basically. It's an update with all the different information, background of the site. And on the front cover is our archaeologist who just retired. She was with us since 1989. And she's going to visit us in June, or late May, I guess it is. She's living in Florida now. She's kind of retired near where her daughter lives. And she is the president of the New Hampshire Archaeological Society. So someone who's well-known in New Hampshire as well as well-known in New England for archaeological work that she's done.
Well,
I've been to see the latest stuff we've been doing up there, and so we look forward to her visit. But that's her on a sifter back in 2015 on a structure called the Chamon Ruins, and we tried to do some restoration on that, and there she is actually finding some, I believe at that point, some historical pottery from the 1700s and 1800s from the Patty family. And we also found some other things in there. Structure, even at that point, that looked interesting, like stone wedges that were probably used in the stone construction. It's a second group of wedges found in that chamber since 1960. So those are in our museum now. So always finding something on this site. I'm sure there's a lot left to be discovered.
Well, and once again, you were introduced to this show in our previous incarnation, and that had to have been almost 5 years ago, because I remember you sent us the images of the LIDAR scan, like the fresh ones. This was the one that you sent that you were literally like, we just got these in. And this one is like very elementary, you know, as opposed to the detailed LIDAR, things like that y'all are getting now from, it's absolutely awesome. And the realms of data that y'all are pulling out, once again, you're finding new structure, you're finding new locations there on the property.
Yeah, even on our property, we're finding those two things. As I mentioned, windows and serpents and more quarried slabs of stone that were probably meant for the main site for more structures. You know, these are big slabs that we use for roof slabs, wall slabs, and that kind of thing. They're still in situ, some of them up to the 1,000 feet from the main site, and actually been detached from the bedrock. They've been raised up and propped. The first one was found back in the 1982, actually, 42 years ago. And that's just some different pictures of the site. That's the chamber in ruins right there. That's the east-west chamber. And you can see the slab work in there. That's the type of slabs that we're finding out all over the hillside, raised off the bedrock with a field stone. And then they were working the edge of the stone in some cases where they needed to shape it or dress it, we call it. And you see the percussion flake and little serrated edges, just like a side on the edge of an arrowhead or a spear point, or even a stone hoe or a stone axe. You can see where the little napping took place, or the flaking by percussion flaking or pressure flaking on an arrowhead would be done with a bone, like an antler or something like that. But in this case, it's on a scale. And so these stones are being found all over the hilltop. And about a year or two ago, I found another one, and it really dawned on me that these people that were building this, whoever they were, had a much, you know, bigger plan for the site. It wasn't me. We always thought maybe the site was built, it's been built generationally. It's been built by different people adding to it. Like Stonehenge is in like stages 1, 2, 3, A, B, C, or 15.
Sure.
And I believe Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which dates back almost 11,800 years. I most current book I read, they think there was about a 1,500 year activity of building there, and they've only uncovered a small part of Göbekli Tepe. But I think our site, I think they weren't done with it. I think they had a grander plan for it, and then they were preparing these slabs down, some of them down the hill. They would have to haul them uphill, you know, and some of them weigh multi tons. And there's another slab that's called the sacrificial table, and right behind it is a vertical monolith slab. To the right of it, you can see a slab on a double. That's actually a two-story building. You're just seeing the upper story of that building right there. And this, by the table on the right side of it, is another slab, and that slab we think belongs on top to the upper right. And it was a double roof slab to that chamber. So we have a two-story building there too, and that stone fell down. And it's never been excavated underneath it. So someday we'd like to get perhaps that stone moved from there so we can see what's under it. It really belongs back up above. We're not in really anymore. They used to do a lot of restoration in the early days of archaeology. And up to not that long ago, but a lot of archaeology today is preventative maintenance.
Yeah.
And they don't like to do as much excavating. Like they like to use ground penetration radar. This is not intrusive. You don't have to dig a hole. But sometimes you still do. Sometimes you have to stay there and look and see.
Well,
even if the radar shows you something, you might have to get in there and explore it, you know?
Well, and this is a prime example. This location on the property, when I was there all of two appearances ago for you, I was physically on property. We did an interview there. You brought me as close as you could possibly get to the altar. It is a true example of this place was put together with purpose. Call it an altar, don't call it an altar. It's just a word, folks. Whether it was used for a dressing table, what have you, it definitely like has what appears to be like a grooved edge around it for collecting water, for collecting liquid. Even maybe collecting juice from berries, what have you, you know, or even, you know, pine nut oil. Who knows? But this right here is probably the best example. This small area is probably the best example of this was a place with a purpose. Directly underneath this stone table, this little edifice that you see here, this wall is a chamber. Where there's a hole that goes directly from that chamber to underneath that altar, underneath the stone slab. So it's not like it was a place that was just a bunch of, you know, medieval hippies walking by stacking stones, you know. This was a place that was built specifically for reasons that, much like its namesake Stonehenge, much like Göbekli Tepe, have not only been lost to history, but been lost to oral history, to the fact that the local indigenous Indians, when asked, when Anglos came and settled the area, hey, what are these wild things over here? They're like, I don't know. That was here when we found the place.
Yeah, that's pretty much it in a nutshell. And the groove on the table is a very, it's kind of a wide and deep groove.
Yeah.
Actually, trapezoidal in shape. We thought it was always a rectangle. But we found out recently that by measuring and also the LiDAR helped us with it. The LiDAR can see down to about 1 centimeter. It has high resolution.
Yeah.
The table bell shape, you always knew the table kind of looked like a bell, you know, in shape. But the because of the shape of the table, the bell shape, it actually looks like a rectangle. But if you look, you measure it, it's 9 inches narrower at the top, where the groove is, the top height to the bottom. And we're finding a trapezoid shape in some of the floor plans of the chambers, including the chamber in ruins with the roof slab that collapsed into it. You showed that picture earlier. But also the Patty chamber, the courtyard where the Patty family house sat back in the mid-1700s. Time after that, the Patty family, who was shoemakers, five generations, they actually set a wooden house over there. That floor plan seems to be trapezoidal. The house sits on it because the sills where the house set are very wide, so they would accommodate a rectangular house, even though the pattern is trapezoidal in shape. And there's a little alcove next to the table, two niches, and we found out, you can even look at it, it's trapezoidal in shape, too. So the trapezoid shape is something new we discovered, too, on top of the other things we've already mentioned. So that's something very significant. But I think it's some sort of an altar. The chamber you mentioned behind is the biggest chamber, called the Oracle Chamber, with five closets. It has two underground drains. It has two inscriptions, one of them called a deer carving, which looks more like an ibex from Western Europe, an Iberian ibex, as a matter of fact, and an arrow carving near the exit chamber. It's a window, not the exit. If you walk through the chamber, I think you walk one way, Chris, and out the back side of it. You couldn't have done that originally. It was just a small window there. And our curiosity is, did the sunlight enter that around the solstice? Because it would be about the right position in the south rising, illuminate that ibex or what we call a deer carving. And that's something we tell even today. You can apps on your phone simulate that, and I think we got to do that, you know, with Sunseeker or something like that, because the trees are still in the way. Even after all of that 2 years of forestry, that avenue was never opened up, you know.
And that is something hugely to consider, Dennis, that we bring up regularly whenever we have you on, is that the trees in the area are not old growth trees. It's not like they're like 100-year oaks or something like that. You know, they're even for New England, pretty new growth, and the place would have been completely different. When this was built, it would have been much more flat and rocky than with the maybe 2-3 inches of topsoil that's there before you hit bedrock, before you start hitting the huge rocks that this place is constructed out of.
Well, that's a good point, Chris. And Pat Hume, our archaeologist that I mentioned a couple minutes ago, she, from 1990, she did a project on the North Stone for us. She actually did an excavation, found a fire pit that dated She found that fire pit dated to about, let's see, what was the date on that? Somewhere around 700 AD, so about 1,300 years old. And the fire pit was actually above the base of the stone, and it was undisturbed. It was right against the stone. So somebody used a stone backstop for a fire about 1,300 years ago. It doesn't date when the stone was set up. It does give you a minute, though, because if the Pat family, again, were shoemakers, had stood that stone up in the complex, that stone, into the ground, you would have disturbed the layers of soil that she found, the three layers of stratigraphy, and the fire pit. They would have been all disturbed. They would have dug a hole, and it would have destroyed the fire pit, basically, you know. And then when they backfilled around the stone, stood it, it would have had no stratigraphy. The charcoal would have been all mixed, and it was not. It was undisturbed. So we have a minimum date of about 1,300 years. The stone could have been standing up, perhaps as early as the main site, which we think was built 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So, she did a shovel test pit study. She went across the 110 acres we have, almost 110 acres, and she started doing these what we call the STPs, test pits, 50-centimeter diameter hole. And you go down to hit bedrock or pre-occupational level where you think no human activity took place below. And she found the soils from bare bedrock, like we have exposed right there with that chamber. You can see it sitting on rock. Even back 90 years ago when Goodwin came, there was some debris in the bedrock. And they did do a little bit of cleaning, but basically you could see bedrock exposed in the main site. And in some areas where the soil collects, you might find up to 2 feet of dirt, you know, or kind of collects against the wall or just the way the land is. She thinks that the hilltop is 75% bare when they built the site. So you had a clear view for the alignments. You would have had bare bedrock to go out and look. Where can we work the bedrock to get these big slabs off of, you know? Because now a lot of it's covered. You can't see it with your eyes, you know?
Yeah.
And if you and I and a team were moving stones up, I think we'd rather have these stone slabs moved on bare bedrock with log rollers than trying to put log rollers on soft earth. Even when the ground's frozen, that dirt creates a lot of friction. And you have the trees in the way, the brush in the way today. But back then, you had a pretty open hill. And so these big slabs are located over the 110 acres downhill. And today, again, we have about four of them that were never moved from their socket, except for one. One of them, actually, after they moved it, it's about 10 feet from its pocket. So I think they were in the process of starting to move the stone towards the site, and they just gave it up. And why did they do that? It's still a question. What happened to it?
Yeah. Well, and you know, that I think is the pressing question more than anything, Dennis, is why and how? You know, because it's one thing to know that your property, which is pretty well laid out here in this LIDAR map, has tons. I mean, archaeoastronomic alignments. Sorry, it's a big mouthful. Archaeoastronomic alignments beyond the point of chance, Dennis. There's no way that you would have that many archaeoastronomic alignments just by happenstance converging on one location like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's been said, you know, you're nothing but coincidence. Like, 57 alignments, including an illumination inside the watch house we found since 2020, actually are all coincidental. I took statistics and probabilities in college, you know, and I think flipping the coin, you know, it kind of rules that out.
Yeah.
You can have a few that would be coincidental, but these stones that are you have the back site where you stood when you look in a astronomical alignment, you need two points, the one near you and the one in the distance, the back site and the foresight. The foresights and even a couple of back sites are actually stones that were taken up the bedrock again in your shape. And a lot of them have the appearance like that when they look like a great big arrowhead stood up. And that's the winter solstice alignment. You can see the arrowhead shape to that. You know, the stones on either side of it are part of the stone wall. And that stone wall, we found out since 2016, actually is part of a 2,550-foot serpent that starts at the watch house from our best understanding today. That body of the serpent, if you will, that wall goes around the site, covers about 15 acres, which might be the sacred part of the land, you know. Although the hilltop itself seems sacred, but that, for some reason, is even more defined, perhaps, as a sacred area. And we saw that at Cajon, they had put a palisade around. There were 120 pyramids there, and I don't know the number. There's about 80 remaining today. But not all the pyramids were inside the palisade area. They put up 20,000 trees, and they repeated that pattern a few times as the trees rotted. You know, the logs rotted in the palisade. They had to rebuild it. But there was a certain area they did that, and that's probably where the hierarchy lived. It could have been somewhat defensive purposes, too, because it's a very, very tall palisade. But it's almost like this is a special area, you know, even at Cahokia. And there are a couple other sites we visited on this, on our 12-day vacation, we just returned. But yeah, 15 acres might be the sacred area. And it's one of the windows, and that's one of the serpent walls also. It's about 100 feet long. It has a triangular stone head, and that's the first window that I found on the property going back to 2016. That serpent wall is shaped like the letter S. You can see the first part of it to the left, to the right. If you really look in the back, see where it sweeps to the left again. It's hard to see. You probably can't see it in this picture. There's actually another little stone for the table, like a little boulder table. That's a big S-shaped, about 40 feet long. Kind of runs in a southerly direction, and it's shaped like the letter S. And that's one of the, I guess we have 15 serpent walls now, because we just found, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, we found
15
another.
Now?
Yeah, because we found about 5 weeks ago. And a surprise for us, you know.
It, Dennis, is, you know, if you were using this to mark property, well, which I don't know why you would, property really isn't marked with S-shaped walls, unless somebody has some personal problems, that, you know, they're bringing to the work site. That'd take a lot of joy juice to make 15 walls like that on the same property, you know?
Because they turn, they twist, they bend, and yeah, you'd have to be taking some moonshine or something to do. Because you see the farmer's walls, and there were a lot of work to build. So the people that built the farmer's walls, I mean, they were professional wall builders, and they were also farmers, you know, amateurs, but they built walls to clear fields of rocks, because every spring, the frost in the winter bring up stones. You don't want to hit them with your plow.
That's right.
Built for boundaries, as you mentioned, Chris, and also stock fences and, of course, the field clearing. Sometimes they're all, for all of those reasons, and there's about 240,000 miles of historic walls starting in the 1700s. Yeah. Before that, farmers and landowners built wooden fences, it seems. From the time of the pilgrims, they were building a lot of wooden fences. And then they came to the wall building era, and they built a lot of walls. And they're all over England. They say they don't have walls anywhere in 40,000 miles.
I would not doubt that. I was just about to say, you are hard pressed to travel anywhere in New England, even in cities, and not find remnants of rock walls, not find rock walls that marked property or, you know, held up somebody's garden or trimmed it in. But you didn't necessarily find rock walls like this, Dennis, that are curved as Kickapoo Creek, as my uncle used to say, like quite literally. And when you start looking at the fact of they have these windows specifically placed in them, and that these windows are all over the place. Once you start looking around, there are these tiny little windows like that everywhere for observation points. And I have made the hypothesis before that perhaps specifically, the structures that are there are used as basically a backyard observatory, where somebody would sit in or lay down in the location to make an observation, to see something coming up over the horizon, what have you, to block out additional starlight, moonlight, things like that from observation distance.
Yeah, the window, that's something we're going to do this summer. We're going to get a GPS their locations. And as I mentioned, we have about 28 of them right now. We're going to GPS them and try to identify them. So, like kind of a name or at least a numbering, you know, so we can identify each of these and then plot them on a map and see what the layout looks like with these windows. And also we're going to do the serpent walls too. And then the third thing, of course, will be the slabs, the 34 slabs that are over the hill. GPS those too.
Yeah.
We can put those on the map, and then we can actually, on the LiDAR map, we can show them, we can take them off by the push of a button, you know, as we're doing a PowerPoint presentation or a show like we're doing right now. Because just to show the enormity of the work on the site. But that's a good question. Why were the windows there? Is there any kind of patent to them? At this point, we don't see any patent to them at all, except they come in one, they'll come in twos, they'll come in fours. And the same thing happens in Connecticut, they're in the Berkshires. Yeah. On Martha's Vineyard, a 1989 book came out called Manitou by Byron Dix and James Cooper Jr. And the book is really like a Bible of these sites in Massachusetts and Vermont. They were familiar with our site. In fact, Byron spent a lot of time at our site on the astronomical work 50 years ago. But when he wrote the book in 1989, he really focused on Vermont and Mass. And on Martha's Vineyard, there's chambers. And one of the walls, they have a picture. The book, and they have the windows. And I read that book in 89. I read it later, and then I read it more recently, and I'm like, wow. But they called them back then were wind windows. They thought the wind blew through the windows, and that was their interpretation. Today, we call them spirit windows. We don't know if we're right. We don't know what the answer is. But they are found in two, and they're called soul holes. And our friend Maria Wheatley that lives near Avebury, right up the road from Stonehenge, she's coming next year to do an event here at our
site. Oh, cool.
She's going to be in Chaco Canyon soon. She just did a thing in Malta, which we've been to. She did another event in Egypt, which I have not been to, but she's been talking to me. And her dad visited us back in the around 43 years ago, 44 years ago. Her dad was here. And so she's going to make her debut here next year.
Cool.
And she sent me pictures of the not only windows in England, And they call them soul holes in Gotmore, and they're in actually some medieval churches, you know, that late. These things were incorporated, and they were thought where the spirits could flow. She sent me a picture of a church near Stonehenge, and it's been stoned up or bricked up behind it, but it was an open hole like this in the church. So I guess the spirits could go through it. Mm. They didn't want wind blowing through the church, so somebody put bricks behind it. Yeah, but it's amazing. She has serpent walls over there, too. In the times, I was not aware of that. She's making pictures of serpent-shaped walls.
Interesting. Now, we've got you for about 25 more minutes. Let's start getting into these alignments that are there, because once again, they are marked. They're marked by stones. Many of them are alignments that occur inside of stone coffers. One of them specifically, and I have some of the stone here. You were kind enough. Please, people, don't just go places and take rocks. All right. Talk to people. I talked to Dennis. I was like, would you mind if I grab a couple of pieces of stone for this exact reason, to show on the show whenever we have him on? Because it's different when you get to see it up close, and when you get to see the amount of schist that is in here, the amount of sparkle that is in this quartzite, that's there, that, yeah, whenever you put something like this inside of a darkened hole and then light it, it tends to shine really sparkly and act like a landmarker. And it's interesting that you have windows like this all over the property, that you have very large stones all over the property like this, with astronomic alignments. Let's start getting into those a little bit, Dennis.
Yeah, so we have the 57 alignments, as I mentioned. The work began in 1965, and I'm still talking to the gentleman who's living in France during the winter, and he goes back to Maine. He lives on an island in the summertime. He opened that clearing as a kid back around 1965.
Oh, wow.
15 years old in 63. So he was one that opened up the winter solstice sunset alignment. And 4 years ago, he told me, we've been messaging each other for a few years now, and he said, Dennis, I have pictures from 1967. Sunset on the winter solstice. I said, you do? I said, I was not aware of that. I knew in 1970, my dad, a neighbor of ours, drove down 8 miles from where we lived in Derry, New Hampshire, and we were there for the winter solstice, that very stone in 1970. And it was a sky, pretty much like you see in that picture, a few clouds, and we saw a very clear sun, the orb, actually setting on the point of that stone back in 1970. And Warren, the gentleman I'm talking about, actually drove up from Newport News, Virginia, where he was living, and he had built a snowmobile out of parts from an old Flyer snowmobile. He must have built it in the late 60s. So he broke the trail. Half a mile through the woods, we had a foot of snow we had to go through. So the three of us followed him up in this wooden snowmobile, and we were there for the sunset, and it was beautiful. It's the first time anybody saw a clear alignment. I thought it was the first time anybody saw an alignment there, but he surprised me, kind of almost like a shock, like you have pictures from 67, and it was through cirrus clouds. So you could see the bright light through the cirrus clouds, but not the orb, but that's in my book. I think you read my book, I think, and you can see picture in the book. It's the first time it's been printed and out there for the public, and so it's 3 years before that. So after that line was seen by him in 67 and then again in 70, the work accelerated because we said, gee, this stone out there seems to be an astronomical alignment with the shortest day of the year on the sunset. And we began opening up some of the other very slowly, but then Warren had gone off to the nuclear industry, and as I mentioned, he was in Newport News. He was putting in two reactors on the Nimitz aircraft carrier, which is kind of in the news because of the TikTok. It's still out there today, sailing after 53 or 54 years when it was commissioned.
Yeah.
And he said they only had to refuel it every 26 years, and he's the guy to help put the reactors on that ship. And he ended his career in Fukushima, working in Osaka, and he was going to go to down to North Carolina to Charlotte and retire for Westinghouse. And all of a sudden, Fukushima mess happened, and he put him on a team, moved him to Tokyo, and he ended up finishing career on that side of bookmarks of the Nimitz and Fukushima. And he lived all over the world in the nuclear industry, and he's very much kind of back into the site after all these decades. And there's this picture there. It's a little hard to see, but that's the very first 1967 picture of what you see in this picture right here. So that's kind of cool. Hey, I never knew about that, you know.
And especially since, like, It's not like you purchased this property. Like, this property has been in your family since you were a kid. Right. And to know that, like, wow, somebody else discovered these things. Somebody else thought about these things. Somebody else was looking into this and at least found the alignment, if anything, long before y'all owned the property and did that yourselves.
Well, actually, yeah. Actually, we got involved because of a radio show in 55. My dad first heard about it. And then by 57, he was working on opening it up to the public. And he had purchased where the parking lot and visitor center is today, but he didn't own the site. That 20 acres, including the site and a lot of the economical lines, went to Malcolm Pearson, who had inherited the site in good first, you know, archaeologist who purchased the property in 1957. So the alignments, however, weren't really known of until 1965. So, and Goodwin back in the 30s knew there were sandstones. They weren't real aware of that. But it was on different property. So this is the main site. But even by the 50s and 60s, some of these strange walls with the twists, the turns, and the bends, and the big slabs of stone, upright stone, were still very interested by the researchers. But by 1963, my dad, I was 65, actually purchased the 20 acres, and that completed this pretty much the sale of the main site and where you see the visitor center today. And then by 1972, we bought a few more parcels to include the glacial cliff shelter, where we found pottery dating back about 2,500 years, Middle Woodland period pottery, and today almost 110 acres. So we wanted to make sure we had all the astronomical alignments, you know, protected, and the land outside of that. Because you can imagine, Chris, somebody would put a house out there and you'd be looking at the house instead of the stone where the sun sets, you know. And that could happen because this whole area here is really grown up. And I was only 18 months old the very first time we came to the site in 1955. I'm kind of dating myself now. But yeah, the research went on 20 years before my dad got involved with the site. It was already being excavated and researched. Wow. Written about. So it wasn't that my dad was walking woods one day, so it was well known, you know. It's written about 1907 by Edgar Gilbert, The History of Salem, and it's all recorded going back in the 1700s, you know, site was here. So, but yeah, we've had it for almost 70 years now. Next year will be the anniversary of my dad first coming to the site. So it's another little anniversary. We just had our 65th anniversary last year of being open to the public.
Wow.
So a lot of discoveries, I think, that, you know, you wonder, you know, today, we know in 10 years that we don't know today. 10 years ago, we didn't know anything about the circuit walls, the windows, the trapezoid shape. Even the standard unit of measure we call the megalithic yard, we're starting to find that, even though in the 70s, when I built my diorama, I was kind of aware of it at our site. We're already aware of that. But it wasn't until more recently we started to find that, yeah, we think our site was based on a megalithic yard, because when you build something, you need a yardstick or a ruler to build it with, whether you use metric or imperial measurements or whatever system you're using. So, yeah, we're still learning a lot about this site. I think the mystery only deepens. Every time we find something or turn a rock over in a figurative sense, the mystery deepens a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's an ancient culture. And they're not only, they're all across the world, but we're finding serpent walls all the way out to California. We meet California by Mount Shasta. Up in Winnipeg, Canada, Pox Canada is working on their serpent walls up there. They're in Alabama. In fact, we're just in Alabama. I wish we could have looked up the gentleman from Jacksonville State University, because years ago he wanted to take us and show us his, what he calls, rattlesnake walls. We just didn't have the opportunity, you know, pretty by the time we could tell Alabama. So.
Now, when it comes to, because of course you, as you were saying earlier, your archaeologist on site was tied with the state. Have y'all ever had any pushback from the state, anything like that, as far as exploration, that kind of stuff? I know that there are many hypotheses out there. One of them, of course, being from the famed researcher L.A. Marzulli, saying that, you know, it may be remnants of giants, things like that. Do y'all ever get any kind of pushback from the state as far as excavations, that kind of stuff? I mean, I know it's private property, of course, but that doesn't mean that they don't own the rights to the minerals underneath it or something, and can just pull a same way that they can pull a halt to your home building if you happen to find a skull or a hip bone. They can call a halt to your excavation, that's looking for a skull or a hip bone anytime they want.
Right. Well, the state actually designated the state historic site in 1971. There's a marker there. The marker is still up today. It's down near Walmart, Salem on 28th. And so it's been over 50 years. My dad had actually pushed for that. He actually tried to push for the road sign on 3 when the highway system came in 1963. Mm. So there's pushback on that. And even later, my dad tried to get a road sign on 92 as, you know, a historical marker. So people going by on the highway, there's a lot. They said, well, you're not significant enough, you know, and you have an ancient site. There's still that attitude out there. Two-state archaeologists, excuse me, a little bit of a...
it's okay, no worries.
It's spring in New Hampshire. It's 46 degrees in spring. That's our spring up
here. I know. I'm jealous. We're already getting close to 90.
Oh, my God. but yeah, 46 today, raw and cold, and I was out there raking the site, and all of a sudden I started getting all congested up there, so I apologize to your listeners. But the state has been, when we had the OSL dates done in 2024, we had a team of about 24 people, Dr. Featherston University of Washington, we had two physicists from Brookhaven National Laboratory. And we had two archaeologists who knew our archaeologist, and she was here that day. And we had LIDAR, GPR people. We had the New England Antiquities Research Association, the group my dad started 60 years ago. We had their team, the OSL team, on. And my grandfather was being born in the hospital at that very moment. So we had that going on 9/11/2020. It was quite the day. But the OSL dates, two of them didn't test. And two of them did test. And the two that tested, one was 1550 AD on top of the roof of the Oracle Chamber, showing that the chamber was there in 1550 AD.
Wow.
The colonial period was here. That soil came in after the chamber was built. So the chamber was here before that. The end of the tail of the 2,550-foot wraps around from the watch house where that illumination was. You showed this film. Mm-hmm. Around 15 acres. It was back in front of the... front of the boulder, which we believe is a head with a face, comes right in front of what would be the mouth of the boulder in the nose, and it does a hump, which we always noticed, and it has a pointed tail. Right in that hump, they did a date of 1400 AD, so that's before Columbus. And we have not heard anything from those two state archaeologists. You think they'd be jumping all over that, a pre-colonial and pre-Columbian date.
Yeah.
And so 22 other places from here to Virginia are being tested. Other stone sites with similar features, 2 hours of the 800, they did 21 more. And those dates were coming back pre-colonial and pre-Columbian.
Wow.
So you think they'd be jumping all over that. I don't know what they really need to get the interest. But their archaeology, if it's colonial, we know what colonial and post-colonial archaeology is. If it's pre-colonial, they're looking for points and pottery in the ground, maybe a living site. Or a wigwam was set up, or maybe a burial. But they're not interested in stone chambers, standing stones, astronomical alignments. That's not within what they've been taught. It's kind of something foreign. Yes. And I told Pat Hume, who's friends with all of those people, I said, your colleagues don't look at these sites, these structures, as artifacts. I don't know what they look at them. But you think the dating alone would say, huh. But they've never been trained in stone structures. They're looking at arrowheads and points and, you know, pottery and tools, weapons, utensils, you know. These chambers kind of, you know, they don't want to deal with these chambers or flippant walls or windows.
It asks a lot of questions to what would be considered to a lot of people sociologically in anthropology, Dennis, a, quote, known quantitative. And that's a conversation that we have on this show regularly. Number one, I love the fact that your book is full of color photographs. Number two, I love the fact that every single scientific report that you are referencing is right here in the book on their letterhead. It's not like you just like took snippets of it. Like you put the whole report in there, and that is epic. Because it does show that path. And it's like we say on the show regularly, it's the fact of the 3% anomaly that we're supposed to be researching, not reconfirming the 95% known quantitative. We know the known quantitative. If you were flying, you were a pilot for years, Dennis. If you were flying your regular route from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I know this isn't a route probably, from Tulsa, Oklahoma to Salem, Massachusetts, that's your route. And suddenly, your route is 5 minutes longer. Despite headwinds, despite anything else, wouldn't that be a noodle scratcher for you as somebody who had a known quantitative that suddenly your entire trip is 5 minutes longer than it used to be? And there's like, we have tailwinds going on. What's happening here? That would be for you as a pilot, something that you would want to figure out fuel wise, emergency landing wise, like that affects a lot of things.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially for planning purposes, you want to know,
For science, a 5% unknown quanta, I don't think I would have been able to pass chemistry with a 5% remainder. Like, hey, where'd that 5% go? Did it go to gas? Did it go to solid? Did it disappear in exothermic reaction? What happened to it? Because your equation is not complete.
Well, that's a good point, Chris. The archaeologists and, you know, future generations going into this, they're just going to find the same old, same old. I think with maybe a few little, you know, new things, you know. And maybe they would argue against me saying that, you know. But, I mean, if you're looking for historical stuff, what surprises are you going to find? You might find a couple if you're looking at pre-colonial stuff.
Yeah.
Unless you look at the stone features. What are you going to find? Another fire pit? Another piece of pottery?
But that is something we have. We have about 9 more minutes, and let's spend it on that. And then the last few minutes promoting upcoming stuff, letting people know where they can go to get the book. But there isn't a lot of that. There's more of that at Stonehenge than there is at America's Stonehenge, Dennis, when it comes to settlements around it, when it comes to broken pottery, sacrifices to gods or to the dead, when it comes to finding graves, when it comes to maybe somebody building a wigwam. Y'all have only had proof to like one encampment on the property right out in front of the visitor center where people park.
It's not like
there are fire pits dug all over the place where people were camping, hanging out, cooking food, even using ancient methods of cracking rock. You would think you would find more fire pits where they were pouring hot coals onto rock than cooling it to crack it and fissure it along fissure lines to pull it out. But there isn't even that.
Mm. Right. I mean, one wigwam site was found 30 years ago, and actually the dates on it were 2,000 years old, 1,600 and 1,200. So it may have been a campsite that was used over, but obviously a wooden wigwam wouldn't last, you know, just several years before you have to stop building it. We've actually built our own wigwams on what we call the Nature Trail, and they only last a few years. Now, Native Americans are probably much more expert than we were at building a wigwam and making it last. But I think the site is fairly clean. Logically, and that seems to be true of some of the prolific sites. Are about 50,000 in Europe. Only Sierra Bray and one called Stanleydale were habitat sites, and they may have a few more. That's just a couple of years ago information. So most of the sites are ceremonial, and now they are finding some of the habitat in the vicinity of Stonehenge, and I think they're using LIDAR, ground penetration radar, probably thermal imaging cameras to find where do these people live. Because the sites itself are kept and that's frustrating to us. We only find a few, you know, stone tools, utensils at a site, probably from the time it was built by the original builders, you know. It makes it hard for archaeologists to really define and to understand the site until you find a lot of artifacts to give more light, shed more light on who these people were, how did they live, their lifestyles, and all of that. But most of the megalithic sites we visit in Europe, we've been to Malta and all around the different countries, they seem to be fairly clean. And the New England structures, and actually going to New York, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere, seem to also be on the clean side. You find some hammer stones, rubbing stones, and wedges. But again, I don't think the people at the sites have kept them clean because they were ceremonial. They were sacred, I think. I think they lived down near the rivers. I think they lived off the hilltop. There is one area, like you mentioned, the wigwam, and there's one other area where we found a workshop, and that's where they were making stone tools. It was rhyolite, the material identified coming from just north of Boston. You can actually identify its source. We just looked it up before my book came out on the rhyolite. We have a picture in the book of that, and you can actually look up and see exactly where it came from in Massachusetts, just north of Boston.
So
about 30 miles, you're making tools. We think that was a living site. It was about maybe about 700 or 800 feet from the main site towards the south. So it would have been outside the main wall perimeter, and it might have been an area that was not a sacred area. So that's another interesting area we'd like to get back into. But that problem is trying to get archaeologists. Our archaeologist is trying to find her replacement, and she can't seem to find anybody that wants to take this up, that is interested in this. They're interested, again, in colonial, post-colonial, and pre-colonial, but they're not interested in stone chambers, structures, standing stones, you know, what you see in the photographs. That, again, doesn't seem interesting. Isn't that amazing? Even with those pre-colonial OSL dates now, and we have taken 16 carbon datings. As you mentioned in there, you showed a picture of one of them, I think.
I feel like I am back in my junior high school play of Little Abner, Dennis. I am stupefied. Stupefied. that archaeologists would not want to continue this endeavor and not want to continue to find out what this location is, because it's not like there's like, there's a thing there. Like, there's a few things there. There's quite a few things. There's like 100 acres of things. and they're literally telling you like, not really that interesting. Not much going on there. I don't know. I don't know what all those archaeo astronomic alignments that are there. They're just not really much to be made out of them. That stupefies me.
Like, it's just a farm, and I lived on a farm for my first 3 years of flying up in Vermont, in North Clarendon, Vermont, when I started flying for an airline. I had been flying since 1974, but 1981, I got an airline job, built up the time, went to college in the meantime. And then I'm looking around at all these places in Vermont. In Derry, New Hampshire, I grew up, there were farms and no longer there. I worked on Cousins Farm in 1969. And on the weekends, I put bumper stickers on at RPM. But I always kept that in mind when I'm looking at these farms that I worked on or lived near, even in Derry or in Vermont. And they don't look like this site. You know, it's not the ivory soap factory, the table being a limestone, a 9,000-pound limestone.
Yeah.
Limestones usually you can pick up. They're like an inch thick, about 36 to 40 inches, and they're flat stone with a very shallow, round groove, and they were used for making soap, or the table being a cider press, so we had the cider factory up there. How do you get your horse down there and your wagon in the sacrificial table area? You can't. There's no room.
Yeah. And that's why I say, maybe something like nut oils, something along those lines, pine nuts are pretty. I mean, a pine marten exists in the area for a reason. There's pine nuts all over the place, even maple nuts. Same thing. Something along those lines, maybe it does look much more along the lines of like a Mideastern olive press, something along those lines. But even then, if it's going to take calling it a cider press, good God, man, call it a cider press and come out and investigate the thing. But but the fact that they have just utterly lost interest.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's frustrating. I keep hearing all the pieces of evidence suggesting a prehistoric site, whether it's carbon dating, astronomical data that the Harvard-Smithsonian Center Physics did back in 1978, saying that the alignments work about 1800 BC, the OSL dates, the stone tools, and the stone masonry construction techniques used to quarry, shape these stones. And that was about 40 years of research by a late David Stuart Smith, who died in 2016, just as we were finding some of the serpent walls and windows. They ignore all of that, and they choose and tend to call the site a hoax, fake, a misinterpretation. Yeah. Oh, it's some crazy farm. How many crazy farmers build something like that?
Crazy?
Seriously, that's your answer?
That's beyond Winchester crazy. All right.
That's opinion. It's not facts, data, and evidence.
And that's just it. You have nothing. A third of the book, Dennis, is aside from definitions, almost a third of this book is all actual data, not hearsay, not conjecture, actual data from laboratories.
Right.
A third of it. So
all
It's absolutely incredible. I'm so glad that you have gone through and written this book. It's one of those books that I can't wait to buy the updated compendium every 2-3 years, because the amount of work that you have put into this book, I know, is phenomenal and amazing. And you continue to discover things on property. You continue to uncover new things, new hypotheses, new theories. So it's fantastic.
Well, the last few years have been very exciting, and a lot of that made it into the book, fortunately. And as you say, a couple of years from now, we may have to update the book, which we will.
Yep. And I hope so.
The future holds, you know.
Yeah. No, and like I said, this is one of those that new editions of books come out. This will be one that guaranteed every time it comes out will probably be close to about 100 pages of new material and scientific information. Because you guys are constant. It's almost like Oak Island on TV, where it's like, I keep reminding people, don't forget, it says one more person has to die. Like they say it in the beginning of the show. So expect them to find no gold until you see another death. But what they've changed is the history of the localized area. What they've changed is the history of the indigenous people who have been saying these things for years. And people have been saying that never happened. That never happened, Mi'kmaq tribe. You're crazy. The Vikings never came and saw you. What are you talking about? Like, no, we're pretty well certain now because of evidence found right there that happened. So what you're helping change is the history of the localized area. What you're helping change is even the localized memory of the indigenous people who don't know what it was for when they came here. So thank you for all your work into this, Dennis. Thank you for your tireless lifetime of work, from bumper stickers to investigation and writing the book. Thank you for all of that. Let everybody know where they can go to find out more about America's Stonehenge, where they can go to download your app, which is wicked cool. Lets you take the virtual tour right there on your mobile device. All that kind of good stuff. Let's let them know where they can find it all.
Yeah, sure. Our website is stonehenge.com. And when you go to there, there's an email. They can actually send us questions. There's a phone number there, too. And then there's the app you can download. The app's pretty cool. It talks to you. It has pictures and text. You can do it from your home. If you visit us and use it as you're walking along, it will give you a kind of a guided tour of the site. And we have a tour guide map, too, that will give you a paper one, when people come in. We're open every day except for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And we're also doing YouTube videos and TikTok videos. We have probably about 100 TikTok videos. They're little video shorts. They're about maybe 2 to 3 minutes of the site, other sites that we have visited, and a few moms we just visited too. And we're on Facebook. And we'll be coming up with the next event will be the summer solstice alignment for the sunrise and sunset. We'll have a celebration. We'll have drumming circle. And we'll have more drumming circles and other events taking place during the summer. And in the fall, around the time of the equinox, I think we're going to start doing stargazing Friday nights. We have a big area we call the Landing. It's a big area that the forestry people opened up for us. And we have log bench seats up there. We just put about 15 of them. And we'll talk about the 57. We'll talk about a We'll talk about constellations, perhaps like Draco, the serpent, or the dragon that may have inspired our teen walls. And we might bring in guests for that. I think it'll be just the fall season we'll do that, because otherwise we either have winter where it's too cold to sit here and look at stars, or we have mosquito season, and that's not a lot of fun to sit here.
Yeah, no, mosquito season is not fun in the Northeast.
But I think September, October, we may look at that. And if we don't do it this year, definitely try to do it next year, but we're going to try to get our act together and do a stargazing event there in the fall. Like Chapel Canyon, they do it on Friday nights. Yep. Around, and we didn't get there in time to sign up. So Chapel is in the middle of nowhere. We went there and they said it's all filled up for tonight. So we missed that one. And then we were at the Open Week where they do it. Moundville, Alabama, we just visited that. They do stargazing there. So a lot of the national and state parks do stargazing on Friday nights. And we want to kind of join that, I think. And I think there'll be a lot of... Let's see if we have guest speakers.
Absolutely. Well, Dennis, thank you as always for your time. Thank you as always for your tireless work at this amazing monument of history right here in America's backyard, known as Salem, New Hampshire. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out everything from America's Stonehenge, as well as buying the awesome America's Stonehenge book, stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can find all of our guest books right there at curiousrealm.com/store. You can find all of our guest books, videos, classes, all that kind of good stuff. You can also like, follow, subscribe, share, comment right there. You can find all of our guests' videos from YouTube. We embed all of their YouTube channels right there on curiousrealm.com/video. You can go and find all of our guest videos embedded. Also, make sure to download, if you're a Roku user, if you have a Roku device, download the all new Curious Realm Roku app, full of episodes as well as binaural beat and frequency meditation music for free. When we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend and guest, Gretchen Cornwall. We will be discussing Knights Templar history, how the Knights Templar came to know of the New World. Was it possibly through the Vikings and their connection to France? And did they maybe make it over here as part of their retreat? We will be getting into that with Gretchen Cornwall right after this. The Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. We were just talking with Dennis Stone in this episode a few minutes ago about America's Stonehenge, some of the history there. And one of the things that is right down the road from America's Stonehenge is, of course, the Kensington Runestone. The Kensington Runestone is one of those that, as we mentioned whenever we have Dennis on, it really shows the fact that there are pre-Columbian visits to the United States. And when you start looking at especially the archaeoastronomic alignments of places like America's Stonehenge, when you start looking at things like the presence of the Kensington Runestone, when you start looking at the presence of the tower in Rhode Island, it really does a lot of things start saying like, wow, the Templars could have very well made it to America. And of course, Oak Island, all of that kind of good stuff. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Gretchen Cornwall. She is the author of The Secret Dossier of a Knights Templar. She is also the author of a great book entitled right here, Oak Island's Mysteries of the Map, House of Rochrequald. We will be talking with our good friend Gretchen Cornwall in this segment. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Gretchen?
Hey, happy to be here. Always happy to spend time with you and have a great conversation.
Absolutely. It is one of those that Knights Templars, everybody can see over my shoulder. I recently actually got a Templar helmet for the studio. I've had the Templar medallion for a long time over here. Not an actual one. That's a replica, folks. good Lord to have a real one. But it has been something I have been fascinated with since easily high school. The idea of this group of monks turned knights that not only protected people during the Crusades on their way back and forth from the Holy Land, but continued their work later and went into all kinds of esoteric teachings, all kinds of esoteric pathways, until the point that they mysteriously, quote unquote, disappeared, which is where the story really begins.
Goodness, there's an introduction. The mountain of evidence is beyond mythological now. It cannot be said that there is a lack of continuance. It's not possible.
Yeah.
They were trading with the guilds. They were merchants themselves. They shaved their beards and blended in with the merchant guilds, which had a military hierarchy themselves. If you were part of a guild such as silversmithing, that head of that guild would have been called the Grand Master. So these very important guilds, the foresters, likewise, in England, had a military hierarchy. So the Templars were part of a family tradition that preceded their own inception and extended past 1307, 1312. Some of them just simply stayed put, as we all know, in the kingdoms that they found themselves in, being defended by the King of Spain. The Portugals were Templars. The mastermind behind the Templar order helped create Portugal, and his nephew became the King of Portugal. But the one thing that they were able they weren't landlocked. And one of their greatest allies were the Venetians. The Venetians were shipbuilders. The Doge or King of Venice went to the aid of the King of Jerusalem, brought 100 ships with him to help protect Jerusalem. The Venetians formed an alliance with the Templars. And of course, you know, we're talking Silk Road stuff. So you get all of these esoteric concepts that are coming directly out of the Far East and also through the scholarship of the Islamic world and flowing right into Europe. And of course, Europe had its own spirituality as well. But the Templars were voracious borrowers of, if it's a good idea, don't shoot the messenger.
Yes.
And that was one of the reasons why they got into trouble. But between the Venetians and their capacity at sea and the Norse and Danish capacity at sea, they all ended up becoming cousins. The Venetians had their quarter right next to the Templar stronghold in Acre in Israel, the last stronghold for the Crusaders or Europeans in Israel was in Acre. So the Venetians were supplying vessels to the Templars there. So there, the alliance is strong, goes way back. And then, of course, you fast forward into the 1380s, 1390s, the Zeno brothers end up working with Earl Henry Sinclair. So you've got that Venetian link to the New World.
Yeah.
So Now, none of these voyages are on a bus schedule. You know, this is a dangerous journey to North America from Europe, from the many ports of Europe, under the many guises of the Templars. And when the Templars split up, they would have had to have become localized and loyal to their king. So you would have had localized Templar knowledge that eventually got split away, you know, from what the Scot Templars knew, the Portuguese Templars knew, even the you know, German and Eastern Europe Templar orders that got absorbed into the Teutonic order in the East. But the trail is quite clear when you have the Vikings raiding Paris. And the Parisian king knew he couldn't take another hit from the Vikings. So he said, okay, Rollo, you're a powerful chieftain. You're going to walk right over us. Here, marry my daughter in exchange for the entire lands of Normandy. And you guard Paris from your kinfolk, and we'll royalize you. So that's 800-something, whatever. So all of that skill, the navigation skill, the shipbuilding skill, the optical, the mythical sunstone, the Viking sunstone, all of that flows into the court of Paris, one of the most powerful kingdoms in Europe. Yeah, that's a nice specimen you've got there.
Thank you.
So all of that knowledge flows right into the court of Paris. And 200 years later, you know, the descendant William the Conqueror goes and takes the English throne by force in 1066. So again, you have that Norse culture taking over the English culture and bringing the French language peppered with Norse. These incredibly aggressive, assertive, but highly cultured traders, you know, a lot of them converted to Christianity because they wanted to have a better trading opportunity. So it's for anybody out there who loves Star Trek, it's very much a Klingon warrior culture with a good dash of Renge tossed in there. Sorry to go all Star Trek on you, but these were the most successful, you know, European culture to cross over the Atlantic. And, you know, we know they were in La Axon Meadows in 1021 at the repair, it's a ship, you know, when the archaeologists call it a ship repair station, then it implies plural ships. It wasn't just a one-off. And I found that they were also fishing in Baffin Island alongside Native Americans near the Arctic Canadian Circle.
Wow.
And they were, archaeology dig that took place with the ancient site of a Nanook tribe, they were surprised to find anomalous architecture there. And they found a wooden carving of a European.
Okay.
And they also found a crucible, a broken crucible with enough ore in it to identify it as being from the Norse kingdom. This particular recipe, if you will, of they were, you know, smelting ore. So they found these objects, you know, where the Nanook tribe had been living. And the date range there, again, goes from, might get this slightly wrong, 1000 AD up through 1300s. But the archaeologists surmised that the fishing was being depleted, and there had to have been a breakdown of between these two cultures, and the Norse left. And that holds true with the copper mining that was happening in Lake Superior, where legends of Native, you know, in the Native American community stating that white men were mining copper between 1000 CE and 1300 CE. So that kind of matches those two time frames. And you've got your, you mentioned the Kensington Runestone, and that's 200 miles due west of the trajectory that the Norse would have taken through the St. Lawrence River Valley through the Native American existing trading and hunting routes. So the only way they would have succeeded in achieving this is through alliances. So they arrived, you know, in I'm sure, a very impressive display, but not in such great numbers that they would have overwhelmed the local populations.
Yeah.
And the Kensington Runestone does speak of a bloody demise of most of the individuals who were left at camp, actually all of them, and, you know, bless their, you know, may God have mercy on their souls. So the bloody tales go. But, you know, the Native American populations were at war with each other often.
Yes.
So they may have aligned themselves with Mi'kmaq that would have perhaps traveled inland with them, and perhaps even the Oneida, the people of the Standing Stone, which I find an interesting culture, considering the amount of stone steles, stone architecture, the Kensington Runestone being one of them, which I do believe is absolutely authentic.
And that's something that we discuss with the, I mean, we just got finished discussing with Dennis Stone, is the fact of when Anglo settlers came to New Hampshire and settled the area there near Salem, they asked the local indigenous population, where did these stone structures come from? What did y'all use these for? They're like, well, like, we've used them for shelter and stuff. Like, we've, you know, we've definitely, like, put things in them to keep it dry, but we didn't build that. That's not, that's not from us.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. And, you know, it's not, you know, it's called island hopping, basically, where you, and the Norse had Scotland sewn up. They had
they were famous for
the Shetlands. They went up to Iceland, Greenland, and then down the other way. Well, so they just followed the arc down.
Specifically.
And then they would have explored the St. Lawrence River. They would have explored and started colonizing the Hudson. And, you know, you fast forward into, can't remember the date. It might have been 2006 or 2012 and through there, where an Elizabethan warship was excavated. It was sunken off the coast of France. And in the navigation box, in the captain's quarters, they found a Viking sunstone. So this technology has been around a long time. This knowledge has been around for a long time. And one of the biggest open secrets going into the age of exploration out of the medieval world was the fur trading going on between the Native Americans and the Europeans. Yeah, there it is. Just beautiful. Just beautiful.
Yeah.
And it was spoken of in such reverential tones in the sagas that historians and archaeologists did not believe it was a real object, that it was some kind of a spiritual object. Now, crystal quartz is a... Icelandic spar has always been held through royalty as being spiritual, because it has these beautiful properties. If you can see through it, it's often used as glass to protect, as part of jewels, you know, like the Alfred jewel. It's, you know, this inlaid cloisonné object of King Alfred. that was considered to be perhaps a page turner for one of his Bibles or Psalms, but it's covered in quartz crystal, but it does have a religious side to it, as being a higher, whiter. There, yeah, that's it. The Alfred Jewel. So, you know, Europeans have been at a royal level been coveting quartz, optical calcite for centuries. And
yeah,
Christopher, as you know, today we know that you can use quartz as a recording device. Yep. And the entire contents of the British Library and Museum will fit into a shoebox on 1-inch by 1-inch squares of quartz.
One of the articles we regularly talk about out of ZME Science, and it was everywhere a few years ago, is new quartz discs being used that will be able to store up to, 360 terabytes. These are about the size of a quarter. They are literally made out of a slice of quartz and can hold that data for 13.8 billion years at temperatures of 190 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
So that means like your thumb drive, which, hey, if you leave it in the car and it hits like 150 in your car, it may actively wipe it. It might very well delete the data on that. And yes, one of the things we discuss regularly, I am a huge user of crystals. I'm one that I love their vibration. It's absolutely amazing to me. To think that perhaps we have had for millennia data stored in crystals or in other means that we were totally unaware of, and that we have lost the esoteric means of tapping that data. No different than if I took this 1 terabyte thumb drive, threw it in the sand of the beach, and dug it up 100 years from now. Would people know what it is? And would they know how to extract the data?
Perfect.
That's the question. So this esoteric data, the data of things like sunstones, how to use a piece of Icelandic spar to refract the light properly to be able to actively find the sun on a cloudy day. Things like that. That is the work of wizardry. That is the work of people like Merlin.
Yes, yes. So, you know, there's a reason for the hushed spiritual reverence for this object, and then the practical side of it, it's going to save your life. And it would have been incised with lines that would have helped you determine your position in relationship to the sun and to not be lost on a cloudy day. You know, you're going to survive that voyage more than likely. A lot of them did.
Yeah. And once the Vikings were masters of two things when it came to the water. A, the island hop, the idea of being able to travel short distances very rapidly. That is what made them excellent raiders, is it did not take them 3 ships of people coming in as a landing force to overwhelm you. It was the fact of 3 very small ships of very dedicated people landed very fast before you could ever do anything about it.
And they were tough.
And they were tough beyond belief. You had to be tough to live where they lived, to make anything grow. You had to be tough to live where they lived.
That's the crux of it right there, because, you know, they had to access timber. They had to have the fur. They needed the fish. There just wasn't enough room for everyone. And they had to get tough, and they survived.
Yeah. And they obviously also had trade routes set up with people, including Native Americans over here, all kinds of things.
Yes. Yeah. It's just astonishing, you know, what our ancestors pulled off. And I believe that there were moments, great moments of peace as well, and moments of renaissance as well.
Yeah.
Human beings are violent. It is inherent in our nature. But civilization is all about understanding spirituality, creating peace and protection so that the arts of science and of beauty can flourish. They don't flourish in times of war. It takes generations to develop works of art that can be, you know, destroyed in a moment's notice.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it's about becoming that knight. It's about might for right rather than might is right. And I don't know of a single culture on the face of the earth. In fact, I looked it up once. I was feeling troubled by the warrior side of the human of nature. Sure. And I found that even Tibet, about 500 years ago, invaded their neighbor to the south. There isn't a kingdom on the face of the earth that hasn't done it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's something as human beings that we need to work on, using that aggression to create, you know, while not taking our eye off the ball, not leaving the back door unlocked, but forgive me, so many thoughts all at once.
No, it's okay. It's okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry. There was a small delay there.
There were times, you know, so basically they came in small, manageable numbers to North America, and they would have integrated, they would have traded, and they would have married into the culture. And eventually they themselves as a recognizable people would have disappeared. But their stories and some of their objects, and definitely stone foundations, worked stone remained.
Yeah.
And it was later during the age of exploration that things got horrible for the Native Americans. Now, we don't know what happened to at the Kensington Runestone site where that monument was carved. We don't know if there was some kind of a tussle between two different tribes.
Yep.
And we don't know. It's possible that one of their numbers was aggressive and did something illegal, you know, against a local tribe. We don't know that. But at the same time, human beings are human beings, and they could have just gotten caught up in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, it's been surmised that this group of Europeans were the aggressors, but to have penetrated that far west, they would have had to have done it by making alliances.
That's right. That's right.
Keeping them, or they wouldn't have gotten there. And when they hit the shores of North America, that coastline there, what the tribes were able to do at that juncture was call up within moments 20,000 warriors. They were prolific. They had a world of plenty, of deer without number, of access to fur and berries and fish and food. You know, this was a strong, well-protected people.
Why? Here's a question real quick that I don't think we have ever explored, Gretchen, especially considering the fact that, A, the Vikings definitely had connection with France, as do the Templars, of course. That's where they escaped their persecution. And, of course, the story always says they went to Portugal. They were given heed and shelter by the King of Portugal there. However, if all this information came in pre-Columbian to France about North America, if all of this came in through Viking knowledge and the fact that they had already been to North America, I mean, we know that we've found Viking camps. We've found Viking swords and fields in Minnesota. The second thing that we didn't get to a minute ago about what they were great with the ocean, was that they were expert river navigators, as opposed to a lot of other people who maybe went up river a little bit, stuff like that. They were expert at navigating rivers and fjords and being able to get far, far, far inland because of the narrow breadth of their boats, because of the fact that it didn't have a deep hull, that it was pretty shallow. They could get in really far inland, farther than most people could.
Yeah.
So the idea that maybe, just maybe, the Knights Templar used this known information to escape to America.
Oh yeah.
Instead of South America.
Back and forth before the Templars existed.
Because it's interesting how all of the Spanish exploration, all of the Italian, every Amerigo Vespucci, the map that Columbus used, everything else is all South America. It's all South America. All of the exploration there went to South America. Why did none of it come here?
I think that in all honesty, the French and the English had created, and the Scots had created, and it would have eventually been English. They Sure. were there already. And the reason why the Spanish weren't up in that area is because they knew that the French, the Norse were there. They were already there in huge numbers, and that there were relay stations along the St. Lawrence Valley. If you look at the foundation base in Nova Scotia, that is
Yep.
New Ross Castle. So you would have had fortresses down the way. Now the town of Dieppe in France was purposefully built up to handle the influx of trade objects from North America. That became the main port embarkation point. So on the French coast for North America. And so the English and the French had never stopped really going. And it was just the biggest, I'm convinced it was the biggest open secret amongst the crowns of Europe. And you're not going to, as a Spaniard, you're not going to want to mess with an entrenched Norseman.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, you're not.
You've heard what happens when you randomly run afoul of them. Lord forbid you run purposefully into their camp.
Yeah. Especially if they developed family ties to the tribes, which I believe they did. And there's more. I can't. Yeah. There's a great deal more. I can't give you right now.
Absolutely, you are in the midst of other research regarding things and stuff like that. And I don't want you to get into that. But it just struck me for a moment that, yeah, there was this huge rush to explore South America and everything. And even the idea of, once again, the work of our other good friend and Templar researcher, Kathleen Ball, and her finding of a Templar cave in Brazil. To the fact of that. But it just dawned on me a minute ago that they would have had, especially with their connection with France and the royal family and everything else, they would have definitely been privy to the Viking information coming out of North America and coming out of the North American coast, and even further inland. Yes.
And we underestimate the value of fur.
Yes.
The French had killed off their bears by around 600, and to be able to claim Wow. you had a bear pelt, that would have been a very expensive prize for a European royal. And they would have, there were laws put into place. The monarch was allowed to wear, certain pelts, and the lower down the food chain you are as a noble, the less bling you were legally allowed to wear.
Yes.
So, the amount of money those bear pelts from North America would have been worth would have been astronomical and highly highly sought after.
As well as the copper, because as we mentioned before, one of the main riches, people talk regularly about Solomon's mines, about the mines of King Solomon and the riches of the Middle East. What most people do not realize, Gretchen, is that that mine wasn't a gold mine. That was copper. Copper was far, far more valuable than gold. And typically whenever, you know, Solomon taxed somebody, things like that, his tax was that of copper. It wasn't, you owe me this much gold, you owe me this much copper every year. Copper was used for so many other things, as opposed to gold. You know, gold is pretty soft. You can't make alloys out of gold that are useful. You can make bronze out of copper. You can make weapons out of copper. You can't make a gold sword. That is useless. That's going to bend like a banana as soon as you hit something with it. You know? So copper is far more useful as a king, especially once, as we've discussed before, once you start getting into nanotechnology. Once you start getting into the concept of the atomic structure of copper and what it's able to bind with, what it's able to do, far, far more useful of a metal. And when you're talking about America.
And for warfare, you know, the byproduct of copper is verdigris, which would have been used in the grooves on an arrow to prevent microbes from eating the feather. And that's what I'm convinced that the Norse were allied to the Cistercians, which is the non-fighting cousin to the Templars. So there, you know, the Cistercians were smelting ore, copper for the war effort of King Sigurd. To rush to the aid of the King of Jerusalem. There it is. And that prevents microbes from eating feathers. So that's a highly valuable substance. And you've got to make your arrows. You've got to store them for a long time as you're gearing up to go into battle. So you're going to need to for your feathers, you know, your arrows to survive the time and the distance, the journey, etc. So powerful substance, and it's attractive. Copper is a good looking metal, and it's, you know, it's very shiny. You know, it's good looking and useful.
It not only has the antimicrobial properties that you're talking about; it has antimicrobial properties for people too. There's also the whole, at least now, the craze of copper grounding, the idea of, you know, you using copper to help realign the magnetic field of your body, the chakral field of your body, so to speak. And quite honestly, there's even the phenomenon of the fact of flowing water through a copper pipe carries a current.
it's phenomenal.
And it doesn't take a whole lot of current to, as we know from things like the, once again, learned in the Middle East, the Baghdad battery, which generates about 1 to 3 volts on average. It doesn't take anything more than that to metallically plate another metal and make it semi-precious. Or make it useful for other things, or even to change the property of other things in an alchemical way. So this kind of knowledge, even though it's pretty modern, is once again very basic. It's not high science. It's not highly complex to shoot water through a copper tube and get a voltage off of it. And use it for something. It doesn't take computers. It doesn't take integrated circuit boards or anything like that. That is as analog a technology as you can get, Gretchen.
I think Europe was full of lost technologies. You know, a recent study was done that proved that we are missing 90% of our secular documents from our European medieval past. So I believe that we are just beginning to rediscover what we knew at that juncture. Through experimentation, through reassessing objects in museums, through understanding people and what was possible for us now, as a human being, what would you do in a situation of X, Y, and Z? You know, people figure things out pretty darn quick. And we aren't the first generation to be educated and intelligent. The Shakespearean plays, for example, anybody that's a composer, go back centuries or not even that long, you had to do this in your head or you were wasting very valuable paper. Today, yeah. We have delete, copy, paste, correct, Grammarly. They didn't have any of that at that time.
Yeah.
Just going back decades.
Well, and even the ink that was used, once again, was almost made through an alchemical process.
Yeah. And there was a sense of reverence and awe,
yeah,
about the products that were developed as having spiritual qualities. So here you are, you know, we view it as being superstitious, but I think that our European ancestors were more akin to, dare I say it, a shaman level of dealing,
yeah,
with their practical objects.
Well, and as we discuss regularly on the show, it's because our connection, Gretchen, I do a lot of astrophotography, as you know. I'm very connected with my night sky. Pretty much, if I walk outside, I could probably, even right now, probably point at the sky or the ground and give you a pretty good idea of where Orion's at. Like, perfect. Right now, it's about right there. In where we're at right now in the afternoon talking, by where it is whenever I recorded at night. I have an idea of that because it's a passion of mine. At those times, when the sun went down, unless you had a torch, unless you had a campfire, unless you had a fat lamp, it was nighttime. You were intimately connected to the stars. You were intimately connected to the world around you. If you didn't know where those stars were and your orientation to them, you didn't know when to plant. You didn't know when to fish properly. You didn't know what food was available to eat out in the woods. You didn't know if it was a rainy season, you might get washed away. You know, Your local medicine man, things like that, had a very intimate connection, a different connection, but the average person had a connection to that. We had a need to know basis on that information, and we have no more need to know. Sadly, we locally have no more need to know. So that knowledge now goes beyond the medicine man as to what these things are and why they're connected, where it once used to be a very common sense thing to us as humanity for thousands of years.
It's phenomenal. The light noise at night prevents us from seeing and experiencing what our ancestors just a few generations ago lived with,
yeah,
in some parts of the world, getting out of town, would give you, you know, that access, but we have less and less access. And I'm glad that they're now creating light noise free zones so that we yeah. can still feel that sense of awe that the jeweled night sky gives us, and that wanting to relate and tell stories in the stars and keep secrets in the stars, such as Mary Magdalene being venerated as Cassiopeia
yes.
from at least the 12th century onward, is astonishing.
Well, and a lot of this, you sent pictures earlier, and you may have been asked, how are we going to incorporate these pictures with 15 minutes left? This is exactly how, because one of the things that they did to preserve nature, to preserve those beautiful connections between what is above is below, those concepts, was their churches. And the idea of carrying that divine and that divine connection down to the common man and being able to transmit that information to the common man through these series of esoteric symbols that if you understood them, if you got them, much like if you understand iambic pentameter as a poet, you tend to understand the works of Shakespeare, whether they were written by him or not, we don't know. But you tend to understand Shakespeare a little bit better than somebody muddling their way through it, because you understand the meter of how it's supposed to be spoken, you know, and even that in of itself is an art form, an understanding and being able to decode the way your life relates to the world around you, to a bird singing, takes an art form. And that is an esoteric thing. And even being able to walk into a space such as this and being able to see this before you and understand that grid over your head is sacred symbology in and of itself. The repetition of the triangle pattern is sacred symbology in and of itself that is leading you to understand the connection of the divine to man.
Those images were a temple church in London. It's still an operating church, the Templar Knight headquarters in London. And it was a privilege to be there. The effigies of some of the most famous in this man in particular, Geoffrey de Mandeville, was a Templar supporter. He and his wife, I believed, developed Royston Cave. And I have many reasons for saying that. On the floor of Royston Cave, briefly, is a carving that might be about a foot and a half long, but it is a sympathetic replica of a brass, I love that, what you would see in a church, a medieval brass floor depiction, you know, a grave slab. Well, there is a small version of a man and a woman on the floor. I would have to hunt and peck on. That might be it on the left there. Do you see that circle there? It might be that. No. Anyway, they are enshrined there, and Royston, the town of Royston, may have taken its name from her, Lady Roysia. He was killed by King Stephen, who usurped the throne from Matilde, who was the legitimate up-and-coming queen. And Geoffrey defended her right to rule, as was the prior king's wishes. So King Stephen basically, you know, had him killed. He died in battle. Nobody would take his body. The Templars did. And they respected this guy enough to bury him in the church. Nobody got that. Very, very few burials are actually in Temple Church itself. But his is. So Royston Cave is an initiation chamber on the tour that I'll be leading this late September into October. I will be bringing people into Royston Cave and also discussing with them the secrets of why Edward III stole properties, ex-Templar properties, on the Icknield Way, the ancient Celtic way. He took them back from the Hospitallers through, So the Edward III in a post-Templar world, who created the Order of the Garter and wanted to align himself to King Arthur, basically created a Templar sympathetic court. And he was within living memory of the Templars, and he, by force of his lawyers, took at least three ex-Templar properties on the Icknield Way.
Wow!
And they remained in the as protectorates of the crown up until the early 1800s.
Yep. Yep. And, you know, not a lot of people, I mean, a lot of people on my show know that I'm a former Catholic seminarian. I've spent a year in the Catholic Church, spent many, many years as a youth minister after. I'm now a recovering Catholic, Gretchen. One of the interesting facts is that the Catholic Church did not always have a celibate priesthood. The celibate priesthood did not come around until the age of the Vincentians. And most of the reason behind the celibate priesthood was worries such as this. Was worries such as, okay, so Padre has a bastard child somewhere. Who has claim to the church property? Who has claim to the church? Now that the father, who's running the church and is in charge of the property, and that's who it's like, it created a huge, huge issue as far as claimants and things like that, and church lines, and what happened legally when it came to property ownership. So, and especially once you start talking Knights Templar, people who are avowed monks, things like that, who have tons of money. The Knights Templar and the Vincentians are two big, big reasons why we presently have a celibate priesthood.
Yeah, and these were nobility.
Yeah.
You couldn't be a Templar unless you were a noble.
And
usually the saints all come out of noble houses because they had enough money to start a church.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right that eventually they chose to become a celibate organization to keep the money in house.
That's right.
Otherwise, you know, and even then you ended up with the schism that Bernard de Clairvaux oversaw. And I believe, you know, helped breach that.
Yeah.
But he managed to get two of his own proteges elected as Pope.
Yep.
That went through his training system. And of course, he was the mastermind. He assisted Hugh de Payen into creating the Templar Order and rolling out the powerful Cistercian Order, which is still well in Europe today.
Absolutely.
And there are two operating houses in England now that were invited back in recent decades. That of course, with the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry VIII, you know, the Cistercians lost their footing in England as well.
Well, we have about 4 or 5 minutes left. In that last few minutes, let's talk about a few more things that folks will be able to see on this amazing tour that you have coming up with Body, Mind, Spirit Journeys. Absolutely awesome. Let's talk about a few more spots that folks will be able to get out to see some of the history behind them.
Oh, it's jammed packed. It's going to be a busy time. I'll be giving presentations along the way. It will be mind-blowingly intensive, from England all the way through to unknown Templar important sites in France that I've discovered, to an operating castle that is a Warcraft museum today, a medieval warfare that was a Cathar castle, loyal to the Counts of Toulouse. But they have working trebuchets, swordsmanship displays, falconry. It's going to be absolutely insanely busy. And what I'm looking forward to bringing people to Chateau de la Rochefoucauld, which was also featured on Oak Island.
Yep.
And their name is on the top of Zena Halpern's map of Oak Island, is how far away it is from the coast. It's a four-hour car journey from Chateau de la Rochefoucauld to the Atlantic coast, and Vikings penetrated from the coast all the way up through the rivers to the nearby royal city, a Merovingian city of Angoulême. That's how far in. So you think about a four-hour car ride without getting out, without taking a lunch break, without, wow, you know, stopping. 4 hours by car, by freeway, you know, so we're not we're not talking about small roads with low speed limits. So that's how far inland the Vikings were able to penetrate with their tight, small craft. Their big, long ships would have had to have stayed on the coast, but their smaller craft could have penetrated inland. And of course, they were able and ready to carve out a few small craft when they hit a coastline and knock down a couple of trees. Get your small craft ready. But, you know, King Sigurd of Norway took 5,000 ships to Jerusalem with 6,000 men. So that gives you an idea of the size of those vessels. They were small enough to handle tight situations. But anyway, yeah. So the city of Angoulême is a beautiful medieval city. So we'll be staying there while we explore Rochefoucauld Chateau. You'll feel the history coming up out of the ground. And it's so immersive. It's so powerful to be amongst these objects that have a history of the same family that built Chateau de la Rochefoucauld have owned it for 900 years. You know, think about that for a few minutes.
That is absolutely incredible. And, you know, the pricing on this is pretty incredible too, for the fact that it is a week long tour, that you're getting private access to these places and that you get all of the amenities. It's pretty incredible. That is awesome.
It's a bit pricey, and you do have to book your own flight, but the hotels are great. A lot of the food is covered. It's an established tour company of 75 years. That's well insured. They know what they're doing. They are vetted. They've been doing this for 75 years. So I've chosen to partner with them. I'm thrilled they want to partner with me. And all along the way, you know, I will be present, and wonderful places to stay. There will be a wine tasting event. There will be a medieval banqueting event in London. There will be free time as well, but it is a bit pricey. But at the same time, if you were to book something like this on your own, it would take a long time to develop this tour on your own without direct knowledge from someone like myself and from this tour company. So it's a good 10 days intense, immersive travel and experience of locations that are known and not.
Incredible.
So the heart of Templar country, Chateau de la Rochefoucauld is in Templar Central.
Wow. Wow, what an incredible opportunity if you are a Knights Templar fanatic to get up close and personal with not only the places that carry these names and that things happened at, but where initiations happened, where people brought themselves to be in the order. So thank you so much for having that put together. Great, Gretchen. That's absolutely incredible. One last time, let everybody know where they can go to register for that, where they can go to keep up with everything from you, because you are presently working on new works, on new material and new books. So where can they go to register for the upcoming tour? Where can they go to keep up with you?
Well, you can follow, you can become a friend on Facebook, Gretchen Cornwell on Facebook, my website, GretchenCornwell.com. The website for mind, body, there we go. It's body, mind, spirit, journeys.com. And it's a fabulous, well-established organization with contacts all over Western Europe and Eastern Europe. They are vetted. They are solid. Their drivers are knowledgeable. Transportation method is well thought out and comfortable. The hotels are vetted. So every step along the way, this is taken care of. So, you know, you can either go on a cruise or you can cruise with me on this one.
Absolutely.
This is, and you'll have your mind and heart full, and you'll get some good walking in, and you'll be in Templar locations that have not been altered by other later generations.
Wow.
So you'll see locations that are not on the radar of locations where the Templars were, and their footprint is still visible. The abbey that I'll be taking you to, an hour away from the chateau, is as it was in the 1200s. And there is a very, very special spire, obelisk of the 1200s nearby that we will be seeing as well. So, you know, these are
too
not
cool,
well-known locations.
And you know, as opposed to a standard tour, I'm sure you can go to the UK and probably take a $50 tour of Royston Cave for 30, 45 minutes and get to stand in there for another 30. However, and I know this because, like, I spent a semester in Europe in 1995 when I was 19 years old, and I know the world is a different place. However, the Colosseum hadn't changed that much. and we had other groups that came around us. They had their flags, all that kind of stuff. We had a different level of access because all of our professors were certified tour guides. So while they were getting a brush over of the Colosseum, we actually had somebody who had a PhD in Roman history sitting there telling us about the Colosseum.
Yes.
When we went to Socrates's jail cell, like, we sat with our philosophy professor and had philosophy class in Socrates' jail cell. Like, the other people walking by Socrates' jail cell did not get to do that. When you're standing in Royston Cave, folks, you are literally standing there with one of the premier Knights Templar researchers out there, who has done more than a tip of the hat of work about Royston Cave. So it's different than your average tour guide, let's just say, to be able to go on a tour with someone like you. That's absolutely incredible.
You know, I've been studying these matters for a long time. I've been to all of these locations.
Yeah.
And it's intense.
Yeah.
If you this is a life event, not...
Yeah, not a tour.
A bounce tour to Europe and back.
That is a beautiful way to put it.
It will be a life event for me.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
To be able to be with a group of individuals who are deeply committed to wanting this experience, finding out more. And you can spend your life on this path.
That's right.
And plan to continue. And to be revitalized by this by this immersive experience. And absolutely. You know, one thing I learned is that you take a, when you go somewhere new, when you're doing something like this, take a picture of the street sign, take as many pictures as you can, because I guarantee you 2 days later, you won't remember what you did. You won't remember. It's so full of experiential, I can't even express what I'm trying to say right now. Mm-hmm. You have to be there. Well, as you said, you have to sit where they sat. It.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a different experience when you get to go in with someone like you that has the realm of knowledge because somebody there at the location may know a lot about that location. They have no idea how to tie together the location you were just at to the one you're at now, to the one you're going to go to tomorrow.
Exactly. And you know, they don't know what to look for either. They don't know why these individuals of 800, 900 years ago, why they did what they were doing.
Yeah. And
it was all about the unseen world. It's all about the unseen world.
Exactly. Gretchen, thank you so much for your time as always, hon. It's always, always an incredible conversation.
My pleasure.
Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Gretchen Cornwall at GretchenCornwall.com, folks, do not forget to stop on by and check out her upcoming Templar journey to England and France, being brought to you through Body Mind Spirit Journeys. You can find all of that information at BodyMindSpiritJourneys.com/Templars to register for that and find out more information. While you are online checking out all of that, make sure to stop by CuriousRealm.com/store. That's where you can find all of the books from not only Gretchen Cornwall, but all of our guests, as well as their videos, classes, and more. You can also visit CuriousRealm.com/knowledge. That will take you to the Knowledge Vault, where you can find all kinds of amazing declassified documents, things like that, to help you truly dig into that curious mind of yours. And of course, do not forget, we now officially have the Curious Realm app. Curious Realm app is available for all Roku users on your Roku devices. Simply stop on by the channel store and download the Curious Realm app. You will get not only all of the episodes, but hours and hours of meditation, music, and videos made by yours truly, binaural beats, frequency meditation, chakra meditation, sacred geometry videos, all kinds of cool stuff. So stop on by, check that out if you are a Roku user, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in as always. It is your open hearts, your open minds that make the conversation what it is. Without the conversation, we go nowhere. Humanity stops progress. So it's because of you that we march forward, everybody. It's because of our mutual want of progress that we march forward. Never forget that. We mutually have to meet in the middle. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, as well as KPNL Radio, APR TV, and the Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit groundzeromedia.org and aftermathmedia.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.